Thank God.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it. Well, I and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. The sun is shining. It's a beautiful day. And we are going to have a phenomenal show. We have Brian Freeman here, the author of My Fight, Love This Guy, I Love Jonathan Stride, The Zero Night. After nearly dying of a gunshot wound, I remember that, Jonathan Stride has been on leave from the Duluth police for more than a year. When his partner, Maggie Bay, she's the boss basically, gets called about a suspicious abduction involving a local lawyer, she tells Stride it's time to come back. That's just part one, and then we have to talk about a struggle that Serena, I love Serena too, is having because of her mother's death. So good morning, Brian, and welcome back to MJ Network. This book really got me. I love it.
Good morning. Well, it's great to be back with you. And, this is the 11th book in the Jonathan Stride series. And anytime you've got a long-running series like that, you're always hoping that readers will stick along for the ride and new readers will continue to embrace the series. And I've been so pleased to see so many of the advanced readers saying that this is their favorite book in the series yet. And I love that. So.
It is my favorite, too, because it brings about a different side of Stride and definitely a different side of Serena people.
Yes, that's exactly right.
See, I got that. So tell us a little bit about this book. And Stride gets, I know, I remember he gets hurt, and I was really worried because I said, you're not going to kill off my favorite guy. And then Serena. So what's the backstory with them? Because they're not happy. That's not good.
Yeah. You know, Stride and Serena, they've had an interesting sort of rocky up and down relationship over the course of 11 books, and I can't believe that going back to Immoral, which was the very first one, if you can imagine, that was 17 years ago that Immoral first came out. So we've been doing this a long time, Fran. But Stride and Serena, I've always said that I want their relationship to feel, you know, real and three-dimensional and authentic. And when I'm talking about a series book, I obviously have a lot of standalones, which is sort of a different kind of animal. But then I've got, you know, the Stride series and the Frost Easton series and the Cab Bolton series. When I'm looking at a new series book, so when I was looking at what to do in The Zero Night, I start thinking not about the plot. I actually start thinking about where the characters are in their lives. And I think about what are the sort of the next steps for them as people and what are the issues that they need to face in their worlds and their lives. And when I think about that and I think about kind of where they're going, then I start building a plot around those ideas so that what's happening in the mystery of the book sort of forces the characters to grow and examine where they are in their lives. And that was true of The Zero Night. I mean, the first thing I did was go back to the last Stride book, which was Funeral for a Friend. Funeral for a Friend, that's such an emotional, intense Stride novel, and Stride is nearly killed in that book. But of course, I've always promised readers I'll never actually kill off Stride.
And that's very
deliberate because I understand why writers will sometimes kill off, you know, important characters because it sort of gives it dramatic juice to the series. I really try to avoid that because I think what it also does, unfortunately, is color and shadow the series for the reader. So they can't go back and reread those books without the knowledge and shadow of what happens to that character darkening the experience. So I may put them through hell, but I try to avoid killing them off. But it meant that in at the end of Funeral for a Friend, and as I was thinking about the Zero Night, I was in a position where I was thinking, okay, where is Stride in the wake of this very, you know, intense experience in his world? And so the action of the Zero Night takes place about a year after the end of Funeral for a Friend, and Stride is still on leave from the police, and he's watching the other people in his lives kind of, you know, get on with their lives, and Maggie is sort of taking on his old role in the detective bureau, and Serena is working for Maggie, and he's sort of kind of struggling with the issue of where is he in life? Mm-hmm. Does he want to go back to the police and face the darkness of dealing with crime and mysteries again? Does he want to do something else with his life? Does he want to retire? I mean, those are all the kind of things that are going through his mind. And so I was thinking about, you know, that essentially, you know, Stride's role in the mystery would involve him sort of having to face that struggle and decide what the future holds for him. And then I started thinking about Serena as well. And, I'm with you. I love Serena as a character. I think when you first meet Serena in Immoral all those years ago, I think people, may have, initially thought, oh, well, Serena's, is so beautiful. Is she, kind of a, is there more to her than her mm-hmm. looks? And I think that, as you get to know Serena and as she's grown and evolved in the course of the stories, I think you really get a sense of the depth and seriousness of her as a person and a detective. And it's been a few books now since I've really had a chance to focus on Serena as a character. And I kind of shift my focus to different people in the series with each different book. I mean, Stride's always in there, but sometimes he plays a greater or lesser role depending on what's going on in the book. So I was thinking about Serena, and Serena is a product of an abusive childhood mm-hmm. back in Phoenix, and she ran away from that childhood when she was only 16 years old, and that's how she wound up in Las Vegas and where she was connected with Stride. And she hasn't spoken to her mother in decades. So I felt like whenever Serena's mother passed away, that that was going to dredge up a lot of issues for her, and she was going to have to confront emotional things in her past that she really had sort of pushed down and hadn't dealt with. And so I deliberately wanted this mystery to force Serena to a position where she was going to have to really start kind of dealing with the impact of her past and her mother, and see if there was a way she could kind of come out on the other side of that. So that was how I started assessing the emotional dynamics of the characters, and then I started kind of building the mystery around that.
I couldn't put it down. Once again, I got eye strain. I sat down and just read it, yeah. And, it's funny because I won't tell you which author killed off a major character, and I yelled at him when I interviewed him in March.
How
could you do that to me?
I know, and again, I get it from a creative standpoint that particularly in a series, if something dramatic like that happens, it forces the series into new directions, and it sort of opens up new avenues for the author in terms of where they take the series going forward. At the same time, I mean, I know it's life and I know it happens, but at the same time, I don't want to sort of cheat the reader like that, and I feel like that puts the reader in a position where, again, it shadows their enjoyment of the earlier books in the series, knowing what the end of that character is. And I would rather not do that. I'd rather,
readers feel like they could
go back, all the way from Immoral and read the whole series over again and feel like they're going to get, the same enjoyment out of those books the next time around. As they did the first time, and again, get to really get to know the characters as they proceed through the series.
Yeah, well, he destroyed the main character too for a while, so I really said, please don't do that again because I'm going to cry. No, really. And the next book he killed off another one, and that didn't bother me as much. So we have a person. Yeah, I mean, he gets.
It depends
brought into
on who they
case.
Kill. Yes, some you're and happy this, to get rid of. So.
I know. I know, because I'm learning from you and from everybody how to get rid of one of my characters if I ever figure out how to write the book, ever finish it. So we have Attorney Gavin Webster. And he paid $100,000. This guy was cool. In ransom money because his wife was kidnapped. She's the local lawyer. But now the money's gone in. She's gone in. Stry discovers that there's something not right there. So tell us about that case. And then we're going to get to Serena and her mother and something that she, someone she didn't know about.
Yeah, Gavin Webster, yes. I you know, it's funny. I've worked with a lot of lawyers in my life. I actually work. I'm not a lawyer myself, but I worked at a law firm for about 8 years right before I broke through with Immoral. And I've actually been pretty kind to lawyers in most of my books. I don't think I have too many difficult lawyers in there. Dan Erickson in the Strine series, he's a little bit of a pill, but most of the other lawyers come out okay. Gavin Webster, he's an interesting case, and I very deliberately structure Gavin so you don't really know what to think about him. And you meet him basically on page one of the book. Gavin Webster is sitting in the pouring rain down in Canal Park in Duluth, and he has an empty briefcase on his lap, and he has called Stride's partner Maggie, who's sort of taking over for Stride in the wake of Stride's being shot. When Maggie gets there, Gavin tells her that that his wife has been kidnapped, and he deliberately kept the police out of it per the kidnapper's instructions, and they demanded a $100,000 ransom, which he paid, but now hours have passed since he tossed the ransom to someone on a boat in the harbor, and there's been no call, and there's no sign of where his wife Chelsea is, and so he's feeling suddenly like he made a horrific mistake, and now he's brought in Maggie. And so really the issue that Maggie faces and that ultimately Stride will face as he gets pulled into this case is can you trust Gavin Webster? And what was the real nature of his marriage to Chelsea? And was this a case of a kidnapping, or was this a case of that something else might have been going on? Because the more they dig into it, the more they find that there may have been reasons that Gavin would have been perfectly happy to see his wife disappear and never come back.
Yeah, well, wait till they find out the truth. It gets really spooky, and I was like, I had a funny feeling about it. Now we have Serena, and poor Serena's mother supposedly committed suicide. And then Serena's going to find out something that she didn't know, right? And she's somebody that she doesn't know about. And the only person that could send to her is my other favorite character, Kat. I love this kid.
Yeah. I first introduced Kat in The Cold Nowhere. And ever since that was probably about six books ago at this point. And ever since then, Kat, has been a very key a key part of the series. She's sort of a reckless teenager, and yet as the books have gone on, I think she's gotten sort of more and more mature and more able to deal with things. And she's always played an important role in kind of bringing Stride and Serena together and being kind of the glue that holds them together. So Serena, I think, always relies on Kat just as much as Kat relies on Serena. But as Serena's getting called out to be part of the investigation into the kidnapping of Chelsea Webster, she gets a call from the police in Phoenix to let her know that they have found her mother, homeless outside on a bench in a Phoenix park, and she has died, and Serena, again, this is something that she's known has been coming, and yet when it happens, she claims she's fine, and she says she hasn't talked to her mother, dealt with her mother in ages. She's okay with it. And Stride, seeing the sort of the deadness on Serena's face, realizes that Serena is, you know, by no means fine, and she is struggling. She is struggling with this and all the things that this is going to dredge up from her past.
Mm.
So Serena gets called out on the Webster kidnapping, but she's not in a good place, and that's about to have some rather difficult implications for her career as she's mm-hmm. struggling with the idea of her mother's death simultaneously while she's in the midst of this investigation.
Well, she does something that causes them to take her off because she goes cuckoo. She goes nuts, and then she does something awful. We won't say what. It's even though it's on the back cover. So that's something. But Stride has to deal with this ransom. So the significance of the ransom and how come something's wrong with it, the numbers don't add up, doesn't add up.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing about this kidnapping is they start looking into it and mm-hmm. Again, you know, I think that Maggie in particular never trusts lawyers, so she's a little wary of Gavin Webster right from the get-go. And the more they dig into this $100,000 ransom, they start to feel like there are questions. For example, I mean, where did Gavin put his hands on $100,000 in cash?
Yeah.
That is not an easy thing to do. And if you go to a bank and say I'm going to withdraw $100,000 in cash, there are going to be a lot of questions asked and a lot of, you know, federal forms filled out. And yet Gavin didn't do any of that. So where did he get the money? And he won't say where he got the cash to deliver for the ransom. And then ultimately when they start finding things to lead them to the ransom, there's hints to suggest that there was not, in fact, $100,000 involved here, that they're only able to locate some $5,000. So what was really going on here, and did this cash ever actually change hands?
Yeah, were there actually really people that... There's a lot of secrets in there, people. You want to read this because, let me tell you, this is really cool. I mean, the character changes are amazing. And then we can't forget Kat. I'm going to talk about Hank Miller. The poor guy got killed. What can you do? She still has that rebel friend, that kid that she's friends with, right? Because she, you know, that's Kat. You have to love her, though.
Yeah, Kat. That's what I really like about, you know, that's what makes the Stride series so special to me, is the way the characters have grown and evolved over the course of 11 books. You know, it's funny because just a few weeks ago, I always listen to audiobooks when I'm on the treadmill, and I decided I'd go back and listen to Immoral, which I'd never listened to the audiobook before, and it's now been, you know, probably, you know, almost, you know, 17, 18 years since I've actually read Immoral. So I listened to Immoral, the very first book in the Stride series, and it was fascinating to me to see how Stride and the other characters are so different today when you find them in The Funeral for a Friend or The Zero Night compared to how they were at the very beginning with Immoral. And that's because they have grown and changed and evolved, in three dimensions in all of the books since then. And I think that's what keeps the series fresh. I mean, I don't think series books, fade away because of plot. I think series books fade away if the characters start becoming stagnant and failing to change. So I love the fact that Stride, Serena, Maggie, as you meet them, today, are very, very different from how they started. And hopefully, when a reader picks up a new book, I mean, I always write my series books so you can dive in anywhere. You don't need to have read the earlier books. You dive in on a new book, whether it's Funeral for a Friend, whether it's The Zero Night, and hopefully you sort of fall in love with these characters, and you want to see how did they get to that point in their lives. Just like if you meet someone later in life and become friends with them, it's not like you're not going to develop new friends, after you're in your 20s. You're going to develop friends throughout your life. And then when you meet them and you like them, then you want to go back and kind of find out their stories. How did they get to that point in their lives? And I think the same is true of series characters. And Kat is a really good example of that. I mean, when Stride and Serena first meet Kat in The Cold Nowhere, Kat is basically, a 16-year-old homeless, prostitute. And She's making some terrible mistakes in her life and making some bad choices and slowly but surely, I mean, you know, Stride and Serena essentially have Kat, you know, in their lives and you know, living with them as the series goes on. And, you know, Kat is slowly maturing and changing, and some of that recklessness is starting to turn into the strength and courage. And, you know, I mean, she's still young. She's still going to make mistakes. But as you meet her now in the Zero Night, here she's, you know, she's going off to college and she's starting to kind of turn the tables and be able to offer, you know, advice and counsel to Serena and to Stride as well in ways that, you know, in the past they would have been sort of trying to help her through their struggles. So I love watching that, you know, that kind of evolution of the character as the books progress.
Well, I think that she'd be very great at counseling kids and everything else. Sounds like a career. You never know.
Yeah, Kat's a really smart girl who just again, you know, had a troubled past and part of that troubled past is where that parallelism with Serena comes up.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Serena feels so close to Kat and vice versa, is they've both been through, you know, some you know, severe stuff in their childhood that kind of led them down different roads.
Could use a cat. So now we come to the poor guy, Hank Miller. He's dead. How come?
Yeah, Hank Miller. You know, I mean, I love the name.
It's like,
Hank.
So what? I know.
Yeah. You know, and so you know, he's just sort of this mystery character that's out there, and he becomes kind of a linchpin in leading, you know, Stride and Maggie into the heart of what was going on in this kidnapping, and of course I won't give away any of the details of what's going on, but Hank, you know, Hank kind of becomes the first little link in the chain that starts to open up what was really going on in the kidnapping, and I think, you know, and the thing about the investigation that leads them toward Hank is it gives Maggie and Stride a chance to get back together, and Stride sort of, you know, dives back into what is it like to be a detective, and is that what he wants to do with his future, is return to, you know, to his old life. You know, and so being back out on the streets with Maggie and interviewing people and there's always the opportunity for some of that sly humor that Maggie is great about, that all of that starts to give a sort of a normalcy to Stride's life that, you know, he feels that old adrenaline of, you know, what it's like as he starts to get kind of closer to the truth.
Well, he better not go back to Maggie because he's married to Serena. So I'll say.
Yeah, no, I don't think we need to worry about that. But you know,
he can't do that.
Again,
no, that would not be good.
Yeah,
otherwise, I'd have to, you know, have to word with her.
Well, that's the interesting thing about the characters. I mean, back in the fifth Stride book, Burying Place, there was this issue with Stride and Maggie that threatened, temporarily derailed his relationship with Serena. And I mean,
I remember.
I remember too, because a lot of readers were really mad at me for the fact that, you know, Stride and Maggie temporarily, you know, had this affair. And you know what I always said was, you know, was two things. I mean, one, you have to, when you're talking about a series book like this, you have to see each novel as really a single chapter in a much longer book. It's you know, what happens in one book, you know, it's part of the evolution of the characters. And the second thing is, I think that, you know, again, I want these relationships to be very authentic and very three-dimensional and true to life. And there was, in my mind, there was no way that you know, Stride and Maggie were so close as friends, and Maggie clearly had feelings for Stride and had for a long time. Serena and Maggie's relationship was always kind of a frenemy relationship where they liked each other, they understood each other, but they never completely trusted each other when it came to Stride. That sooner or later there was going to have to come a time where Stride was going to turn to Maggie, and this was going to cause, you know, problems in the nature of that triangle. It just felt to me like that's something that had to happen, that those characters were going to have to explore that and get through it, even if it was, you know, a very rocky, difficult, change in the dynamics of their relationships. That was something that was sort of a true life inevitable thing that was going to happen in the real world. So it meant that was something I was going to have to deal with in the books. So, and again, that's part of the process is having these characters, grow and evolve and change in ways that readers understand and can relate to, even if they may get mad at the characters for some of the mistakes and poor choices they make.
We'll have a character that we don't like. Here he comes. Then Stride can't stand him. That's Lance Beaton. He doesn't want to deal with this guy, right? And then we have Chelsea, who's missing. So how does she fit in? And then we get to the good part next. You won't believe what we're going to find out.
One of the fun things about a series book is the opportunity to introduce sort of quirky new characters that become foils for the heroes. And Lance Beaton is I love Lance. He's new to the series, and he's a superior police officer, and by that I don't mean that he's better than anyone else. He works in Superior, Wisconsin, which is right on the other side of the bridge from Duluth. And Lance is just one of those folks that's happy to take credit and likes to kind of see his name in the headlines and so he's always been kind of a foil for Stride and Maggie, and so they have a lot of fun talking about Lance and Maggie in particular. I think has makes some great jokes at Lance's expense I think, again, it's little elements of humor, I think, are really important in the kinds of books that I write. Because, I'm dealing with intense, deep emotions among all the characters. I'm dealing with dark things happening. I don't tend to use explicit violence, but, violent things are happening. These are mysteries and thrillers. And so I think it's helpful to have those little moments of humor that just sort of give the reader a little bit of a break from the darkness and the drama. And, Maggie in particular is really good about that. And I think that having had the opportunity to introduce Lance, it anyone who frustrates Maggie is going to be, the subject of her jokes. And that when a frustrated, pissed off Maggie is always a fun character to read about.
Yeah, I know. But we have Chelsea, but here we go. Kat is about to find out something, and Serena has to face something. Who is Delaney, and what is her reaction when she finds out her mother's dead? And uh-oh, what does Serena think? That was really whoa.
A couple things. One is that I love having sort of little inside jokes in my books, and obviously most people aren't even aware of them. But there's a lovely young woman named Delaney Vavra, who's a real person in Duluth, and she was helping us out at one of the big Duluth events a few years ago, and her family they're huge fans and supporters of my books, so I thought it would be a lot of fun for them if I included a character in one of my books named Delaney, and so that's where Delaney came from as a character, and so that kind of thing is always really fun for me as an author, what's going on here with this separate case, this cold case. We mentioned that Serena makes some rather significant mistakes as she's investigating the Webster case, because of, again, the issues of her mother are starting to weigh on her, and ultimately Serena gets pulled off the Webster case and essentially sort of suspended in place, and Maggie tells her to stay off the case and kind of keep a low profile. Because otherwise, she's just plain going to have to, kick her off the force for a while, and so Serena is feeling, frustrated and unhappy with where things are, and she starts digging into her cold case files, she finds herself stopping at a case that came up a couple of years earlier where there was a suicide, it involved a mother who ended up leaving her daughter, Delaney, on her own. And Serena finds herself drawn back into this case. Initially, she thought it was pretty open and shut that the woman had killed herself. And Serena, as she rereads the file, begins to realize that she may have kind of jumped to conclusions about what was going on there, because the woman's family didn't believe that she would ever have committed suicide and left Delaney alone. And now here's Serena, who, of course, essentially is an orphan herself now, with her mother having passed away, and understands the idea of being, on her own as a teenager. And so she starts beginning to dig into this case again and starts to ask questions again about, was this really a suicide, or is it possible that she actually made a mistake and wrote off a case that had more complicated issues behind it? And that's what, brings her in touch with Delaney. And she starts to, ask Delaney questions and finds that, Delaney seems to be keeping secrets of her own. And Delaney is both a teenager and a college student, and so she's going to the U of M like Kat is. And so Kat ends up getting pulled into this as well, because Kat starts to get to know Delaney and talk to Delaney and starts to try to get information for Serena about what are the things that Delaney's not telling, not admitting to about her relationship with her mother and what was really going on back then. So it becomes not only a very intricate part of the mystery, but at the same time, it also makes for a really interesting dynamic of relationships with Serena and Delaney and this old case, and how this dredges up everything about her own mother. And then Kat and Delaney sort of, stumbling their way toward a friendship, because they're both very smart. They've both, had a lot of stress in their lives. And Kat has never been good about having, girlfriends. And so she's starting to kind of, see if there's an opportunity here for her actually to trust someone and become friends with someone in this new part of her life. And so I like where that whole relationship is going.
Well, there are a couple of characters that I have. I'm so aggravated. I had I just created these questions last night at 10 o'clock, as you know, because, like I said, my computer deleted my review and everything. The reviews are my notepad, so I'm not worried about that. The questions just disappeared, so what can I say? But there are a couple of characters that deal with what happened to Chelsea and about the ransom money. But this scene really got me. There's a little boy, and this is a third plot, right, Brian, with abuse, child abuse. So Serena has to deal with a little boy named Elton who needs to be in child services. So what does she do? And I would have done the same thing.
That's not quite true.
I know. I know. I would have done the same thing, sort of.
Yeah, it's similar, but Elton, well, first of all, I think readers will sort of get the clue that I'm sort of an Elton John fan, since my preceding book was Funeral for a Friend, which of course is based on the title of an Elton John song. And now here we have someone named Elton showing up in the Zero Night. But here's the thing. Elton is not a boy. Elton is a dog.
Yeah.
And
I know.
And
I love Elton.
So Serena is still on the Webster case, and she goes to talk to the Webster's neighbors across the street, basically to find out, did they see anything the night that Chelsea Webster was kidnapped? And as she's going to talk to this upwardly mobile newcomer family in Duluth, she finds that their dog, their border collie, is leashed, tied up outside, soaking wet because the rain's been coming, and nobody inside has remembered that the dog is still outside in the rain. And so Serena, tells them, hey, you've got to bring your dog in. And they're making excuses back and forth, and they're saying, and the husband and wife start arguing that the kids aren't taking care of the dog, and And in the midst of all this, they still don't bring the dog in. And so after this interview, Serena goes outside and waits, and more time passes, and she hears, you know, more arguments, and hears the kids up inside, and they still don't come in and take their dog out of the rain. And Serena does something that I don't think even she really understands, but she ultimately just plain takes the dog. She you know, takes it off its leash, takes it to the car,
yeah.
essentially steals the family's dog. It's one of those moments that's really important in the creation of a book for me, because I try to outline loosely that I know where the story is going. I know all the key benchmarks of the mystery. I know who did what to whom and why. But what I leave open is the idea that things can come up along the way that I'm not necessarily anticipating that will shape where the characters are going. When I did an outline for The Zero Night, there was no Elton in the outline. There was no Serena stealing the dog. It was truly, I didn't. And when I got to the chapter where Serena is going to interview this family, it was as if, Serena discovered this dog at the same time that I discovered this dog. I wrote it into the chapter and got to the end of the chapter and realized that this was what Serena was going to do. She was going to take that dog, and that somehow I knew that this dog and the act of stealing this dog was an important part of Serena dealing with her childhood and what happened with her mother. And I didn't even really know exactly why at that point, but I knew that this was significant. And so that's why Serena takes the dog. And of course, it sort of blows up in her face. Maggie can't understand what the hell's going on with Serena, and she's telling her, you gotta give these people back their dog, and she doesn't. And she takes the dog with her, and it's as if, it's Serena needs to have this, this dog with her, and she starts telling the dog things about her past that she hasn't told Stride and she hasn't told Kat. And Kat, of course, thinks this is all very funny, and she comes, to visit Serena, and they're out on the beach, and she's looking at the dog, and she's like, well, did you replace me with a dog when I went away to college? And so Elton is, he's an important character in the book, even being a dog. And I think that you ultimately can't really understand Serena and her past and her childhood and her mother without understanding the nature of Serena's relationship with Elton, the dog. And
that's why I said he was a child. Because everybody considers their dog their child, well, especially my brother, who considers Bella his, and she's huge. She's a pit bull, Rottweiler.
Yep.
She's huge. Yep. But Elton, there's a lot of abuse between animal abuse and whatever, and I get upset because I was in a pizza place a long time ago in the Bronx before we moved, and this lady was with her dog. I said, if you want to lose the dog and your kids, you better knock it off. Because I could tell child abuse, like I dealt with it in school. It's terrible. But Serena has a problem. So trust is a valuable asset between Serena and Stride, right? And Kat comes to play, but we have to get back to Chelsea. Why was Chelsea in Hink's house? And I'm not sure if I have the right word, but this is this Broadway and Gavin, and what are geocaches?
Yes, I
had to go through the book last night. I was having a fit because of these questions, whatever, but I wanted to make sure. Yeah, so tell us about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, this investigation into the kidnapping takes all sorts of interesting little twists and turns. There's a lot of secrets that Gavin Webster is keeping about his job as an attorney and who he represents, mm-hmm. and the nature of his relationship with his wife, and the investigation to take Stride and Maggie to ultimately meet a very interesting person who simply goes by the name Broadway. And Broadway's an all-new character. He's one of my favorite new characters. He runs this he's very mysterious. He runs this illegal gambling operation in Duluth. And it's an under-the-table gambling setup where rich people in Duluth come secretly to this location, which is always changing. And as they investigate, they see that Gavin was involved in trying to get rid of the legal hurdles that Broadway faced, and that that there's some kind of relationship. And of course, when you're talking about an illegal under the table gambling operation that involves a lot of cash trading hands, Stride and Maggie's first question is, well, if Gavin found $100,000 in cash to pay the ransom, did he get this from Broadway? And so Broadway is this very, he's a young, smooth character. I am confident we will meet Broadway again in a future Stride novel because he's just a great character. But that's how they start to kind of dive down into the issues of what's really been going on with Gavin Webster. And and then one of Gavin's strange hobbies begins to come to the fore. And Gavin is into geocaching. And I don't know if you and your listeners know what geocaching is, but it's a hugely popular hobby. And there are, websites devoted to this and databases of geocaches. Essentially what it is that, all over the country, really all over the world, people go and hide little things in unexpected places. And there are databases of where these geocaches are. And what the databases include are the GPS coordinates for the database. So that will get you within probably, 20, 30 feet or so of where a geocache is located. And you have thousands and thousands of people that do geocaching as a hobby, and they will use the GPS locators on their phone to hike through the woods and in urban settings to find the locations where these geocaches are hidden, because once you get there, it's not necessarily that easy to find. The GPS will get you close, but then you have to figure out where is it really hidden. And when they find it, they don't take it. The point is that they just put their names on a list that they were they were ones that found it. And most of what's in these things are sort of nonsense little things. Stride and Maggie begin to discover that Gavin was out geocaching. And yet, was he out geocaching? Because, he's traced to sort of a distant location in the woods, and that leads them to wonder, was he out geocaching or was he actually scouting locations where one might hide a body if one had not actually kidnapped your wife, but in fact had murdered her. So that whole geocaching issue becomes kind of a question of what was Gavin really doing out there in the woods, and what are they going to find when they start looking?
Well, wait, before I forget, on Tuesday next week, okay, people, I did 4 interviews this week. This is the 4th one. I'm really impressed with myself. And on the 1st, we have New York Times author Deb Pine's Wicked Schemes. On the 3rd, we have a different kind of show. Pastor Michael Jones will talk about his new online university and how he feels he wants to teach new authors how to become Amazon authors. On the 7th, I have to redo The Perfect Brother because we had the clock went out on, I don't know how that happened. I wrote 120 minutes and they did 15, so I have to do that over. On the 8th, I'm excited. Philip Margolin is going to be here with Murder at Black Oaks, a Robin Lockwood. And he better not kill off any more characters. Seriously. He's great. I know. And on the 10th, I didn't get a confirmation, but he better do it. John Land, Blood Moon with Henry Graham. On the 14th, we have the number one pain management interventionist doctor in Westchester, Dr. Sabina Hsu, When It Hurts, and with Linda Speer, her co-author. On the 16th, we have a panel show. We're going to talk about crime and true crime. And that's just part of November. And December is even big. And if you have a new book, people, coming out, you better tell me, because I got two more dates left in January, and February is starting to fill up for whatever reason. Yeah. So the most important thing is the conference is Zach and Delaney and the confrontation between Kat and Delaney. So how is that, Zach, in relation to Delaney?
Yeah. Delaney. I really love Delaney as a character, and me too. I see more for her in the series as well, because I think there's just some real opportunities for growth, and for that friendship between Kat and Delaney, I think, can play an important role going forward. But Delaney, like Serena, is dealing with issues connected to her mother, and her mother committed suicide, or did she commit suicide? And what secrets is Delaney keeping from back then that is part of the stress of her life? Zach was her boyfriend back then, all of a sudden, after having been close to Zach for a long time, and they were getting ready to go to college together, suddenly Delaney just dumped Zach and walked away and broke off the relationship and never really explained to Zach why she did that. So Kat's trying to find the answer to that question, and Serena is starting to dig into what role did Zach and his family play in this, and does any of this somehow tie into what really happened to Delaney's mother? And so it becomes a very intricate web among the characters, but it forces Kat and Delaney to kind of face each other, talk to each other, and they're both smart, they're both competitive, they both struggle to trust other girls, and yet they start to realize that they can each rely on the other, and that there's something there in terms of their friendship.
Well, the history with Serena, I figured this one out. I understand what zero night means.
Yeah,
I got that.
That's an important thing. I mean, people ask me, well, what's the nature of the zero night in terms of the title? And Serena as a character, I mean, Serena coming out of her past, I mean, she's an alcoholic, and she knows she's prone to substance abuse and addiction, and she's been sober for a long, long time, and like many alcoholics, she has sort of mentally kept count of the number of days that she's been without a drink. And sort of each night before she goes to bed, her mind kind of automatically ups that number by one. So she knows exactly what the number is, the number of nights that she survived without having a drink. And so given everything going on in Serena's life, the loss of her mother and the suspension from work because of her mistakes, and this new cold case that she feels she may have made a horrible error in judgment about what really happened to Delaney's mother, all that is feeding into that wavering of where is she in terms of her sobriety. And so that really becomes a key question of the whole book, is Serena able to maintain her sobriety, or will that number in her head ultimately go back to zero? And so that's where the title comes from. That's the essence of the zero night.
Well, I a lot of people have alcohol addictions, which is really sad. I personally have, the only addiction I have is coffee. That's it, people. Caffeine.
Yeah, I share that one with you, yes.
and I overdo it. I mean,
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, for those of us that did, when your stomach bothers you, who cares? Today I only had three so far, and I'm definitely going to have two more. It makes me feel so much better. I'm allergic to real milk. So I can't eat ice cream. And I can't have cake because it's got milk in it. So my only, is that. And for those of you that are allergic to milk, oat milk ice cream isn't bad. It's got you, but you got to be careful. It's too much sugar. But so I stay 106 pounds and don't have to worry about gaining weight. So coffee's it. So What does Serena still have to face? She and Stride have to really come to grips because the two of them are still at opposite ends of the world. So what's going to happen with them? Because I'm worried. You can't get them divorced. That would make me very sad.
No. But yeah, that will be the interesting thing. I mean, again, I'm always the first thing I'm looking at in terms of a series book and where it goes next is where are the characters? I know that as soon as the Zero Night comes out, I'm going to have more people asking me that, you know, is this the end of the Stride series?
No.
And I get that with every book I think that's very deliberate because I try to end each book with sort of a sense of emotional closure. I want and I do that very deliberately because I want if for some reason, I mean, I want to be continuing to write Stride books for a long time to come, but I know that, you know, life is uncertain and you never know what the future brings. So if for any reason I was not able to do more Stride novels, I want to end each book in such a way that readers feel like it's a complete creative product. And if that were the last book in the series, then they'd be able to read the entire series and get that sense of emotional closure that brings everything together. That was true at the end of Funeral for a Friend. I think it's also true at the end of the Zero Night. But obviously my hope is to keep, you know, keep those things going and there's lots of opportunities, I think, based on where the characters are for what kind of happens next in their lives. But for me, the interesting thing is I don't know. I don't know where they go next. I sort of deliberately don't really think about that until I get to the point of starting to plot out a new Stride novel, because at that point, then I can start really sort of reflecting on where the characters are in their lives and what's going to happen next. But for the moment, I like kind of where I've left those characters and then we'll see what the future holds.
Well, what's next for you and where can everybody get all of this series? By the way, the book I really loved this year was I Remember You.
Yeah, I Remember You is I've been thrilled with the reaction from readers on I Remember You.
I love that
book. It's a
very
it's a Michael Crichton-esque kind of thriller, really sort of an interesting out there kind of medical sort of thriller. And the readers have just really taken to that book, which I love. And it's a standalone, which again means people can dive right in without any issues.
Yeah.
It's been a busy year. I mean, you figure really I've had four launches this year. The Ursulina, the print and ebook edition of the Ursulina, the follow up to the Deep Deep Snow, came out in February. So much has happened since then. I can't believe that, you know, it was only this year that the Ursulina came out. And then my third Jason Bourne novel, The Bourne Sacrifice, came out in July. And
it was
I
good,
remember
too.
You came, it's really so much fun writing the Bourne novels. In fact, the fourth Bourne novel is already done. I'm in the final stages of getting that ready to turn in. And then I Remember You came out in August, and now we have Stride coming out on November 1st. So it's been a big year. I feel like I'm slacking. You know, I've only written one book this year. I've written the fourth Bourne novel this year. But there's been a lot going on for me and Marcia this year, so it's been kind of good to have an opportunity to actually, you know, not spend every waking hour writing. Next year will be a little lighter in terms of launches, but after, I think, 9 books in the last 3 years, I think I've earned a little bit of a break from that. So, but next year the writing schedule is going to be kind of crazy again. And multiple projects on the horizon, all of them really interesting and fun. So I'm really looking forward to that. And if people want to find out more about my books, they can go to my website, which is bfreemanbooks.com. That's all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. And there's summaries of all my books. There's links to purchase them online. You can find out everything about my different series, about the Bourne books, about Stride, about my standalones. So that's all out there at bfreemanbooks.com. And then folks can find me on social media as well. I'm on Twitter and Instagram, also at bfreemanbooks. And then I'm on Facebook at facebook.com/bfreemanfans. And I love hearing from readers, whether they send me emails, whether they post on my social media pages. That's always really fun for me. I like to have a chance to build relationships with readers and hear what they think about the books. So I'm out there on my social media accounts every day. So I always encourage people to send me messages and posts and send me emails. I love to hear what they think about the books.
Well, people, you're going to hear my voice on Tuesday when I post my review. Fran doesn't post negative reviews ever. I have them all. I have a creed. If I don't like the book, and it's not 3.5, 4 stars, that wouldn't happen with yours ever. I don't review the book. I just write a summary. Every author writes something, and they really work hard, and it's wrong to sell somebody that their book is horrible. And
yeah,
I know how that feels.
Yeah, and I think
I know
that's,
how
a really, that's a really healthy. I think that's a really healthy approach too. I mean, I think that so much of our society has become so critical and harsh and negative. And I don't know whether it's TV shows like Survivor and the Voice and all these things where they just have all these critics that make ratings mean to people. And I think I find that very discouraging. And I totally agree with you. I mean, it has being an author has made me very sensitive to how I review other sorts of experiences in my life, whether it's restaurants or movies or hotels or whatever. I look at these things and I think I look at these things and think whatever it is, there have been a lot of people that have put their heart and soul into this, and the fact that I don't like something, if I don't like a movie, if I don't like a book, if I don't like a song, that's okay. I mean, there are plenty of different genres and plenty of different experiences for people, but because I don't like it doesn't mean other people aren't going to like it, and I'm not going to dump on the efforts of another artist because if it wasn't for me, that's fine, then they weren't writing for me, but there are other people out there that will take things away from it, and I don't want to discourage those people from trying to find it and discover it, because if somebody doesn't read something or watch something because I said I didn't like it, well, maybe they're missing out on a great experience. So
I agree. And, it's funny because I've been elected as an elite reviewer for Yelp, seriously. And yell at me.
My brother, they don't do
book reviews, but I do restaurant reviews. And the pizza place down the block is a brand new guy, and they make specialty stuff for me. I can't say what, but they go out of their way for me. And the last time I put a review, 594 people thanked me for writing the review on Yelp.
Right.
I can't believe everybody reads this. They do. So, people don't realize they do read your work. When I post your review on Tuesday, I guarantee 20 people are going to read it in 5 minutes, because I don't know why, but they just read just reviews. But thank you so much. And tell Marcia she's doing a great job, promoting him. She's great.
Thank you. Thank you, Fran. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. And everybody, it's a beautiful day outside, but first go to the bookstore and get a couple of copies of Zero Night. Order them online. Hanukkah's coming. Christmas is coming. And the best present to me is a book. Everybody have a great day. Thank you, Brian. And bye.